Please stand by. Good day, everyone, and welcome to the IBM teleconference. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded. And now for opening remarks and introductions, I would like to turn the call over to Diane McCallum. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Welcome, everybody, to imagine not having to write a single line of mainframe code, but being able to create web access, SOA, ETL, and business continuity solutions. My name is Diane McCallum, and I am the worldwide sales leader for IBM's DB2 for Z and DB2 and IMS tools, as well as II tools. I will be your host today. Our first speaker is Raj Dada, a member of the WebSphere Information Integration for Z Solutions and Deployment team. Following Raj will be Beth Hamill, an Information Integration Solutions Architect. So now I'd like to turn it over to Raj. Raj?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. I am a solutions architect for the Information Integration Solutions team out of Silicon Valley Labs. And I'll be talking to you about how we can provide mainframe data access from a web app, create ETL from non-relational mainframe data, and create an SOA infrastructure based on the mainframe data, all using Classic Federation. And you can do all of that without writing a single line of mainframe code. So I'm starting on slide 3. The slide introduces the product WebSphere Information Integrator Classic Federation, which I will call Classic Federation for short. It is a product that provides read and write access, and the write access is in a transactional manner. So basically, Classic Federation allows you to mimic the functionality of a relational database like DB2 on underlying data that can be VSAM, sequential, IMS. These all come from IBM, or software AGs, IDBAS, or CAs, Datacom, and IDMS. It is a very highly scalable product. We have customers running it in production, running literally millions of transactions a day. The key component of this product is its metadata. What that means is you can actually deploy entire applications without writing any mainframe code. It also means that all your work is kind of front-loaded. So you do your mapping at the beginning, and that's it. There is no maintenance required. Even if your other mainframe applications change, even if you keep adding some new fields to your data, the Classic Federation interface is not touched. Unless, of course, you change some of the definitions that we are accessing. So it gives you ease of install, very low maintenance, and to top it all, this is a product that integrates really well with your existing mainframe infrastructure, like security subsystems, RACF, top secret, and ACF2. In the front end, it integrates with application development tools like WebSphere Application Studio, Microsoft.NET, standard J2E platforms like WebLogic, JBoss, and reporting tools like Crystal Reports, Brio Query, and ETL products like IBM's own DataSage, even competitors like Informatica. So that's a brief two-minute introduction to the product that we call Classic Federation. And in the next few slides, I will show you how we use this product to give you web applications, ETL solutions, and SOA infrastructure solutions. I'm now on slide 4, which gives you an overview of what is involved in deploying Classic Federation. The key part, obviously, is the mapping. We are talking about mapping non-relational data structures like IMS, which has a hierarchical structure, into a relational form. That is done using a tool called DataMapper. And the DataMapper is a Windows application. It allows you to import IMS or IDMS or whatever non-relational data source you have and create relational virtual tables, virtual relational tables, and store them in the metadata catalog. This you will do with as many applications as you bring online, so it is a iterative process. The other two components are the server component and the client component. The server is basically a started task that runs on the mainframe, and it has some database-specific engines. So we'll provide you a connector if you have IMS, another connector if you have Adabas, and so on. The third component is the client piece, which can be JDBC or ODBC. These are standard interfaces. With JDBC, we are compliant with the 2.1 standard and quickly moving towards the 3.0. We already actually support some 3.0 features. And with ODBC, we are at the 3.5 level, so we are pretty much at the industry compliance level. Now I will move to slide 5, where I show you the entire picture of your solution. So as I was talking about, the mapping piece comes first. It's on your left. Use that to map your data, store it in on the mainframe in the form of the metadata catalog. And then you have the operational pieces. So this mapping is done actually offline. It's done ahead of time before you're planning to do the access. When that is done, the server comes up running as a started task, just like CICS or your IMS DC address space. So it looks and feels just like an online region. So one of the clients that you are using, either ODBC or JDBC, they will send across a SQL query. And the task, the classic data server, has a key component, the query processor, which I like to call the brains of the product. It parses the SQL and figures out from the metadata actually which target it is for. For example, it might be an SQL on a virtual table that has been created on a set of IMS segments. The query processor, when it parses it, figures that out and creates a structure which is tailored for the IMS component. So it sends this structure across to the IMS component, and the IMS component is actually a little piece of code written in assembler. Its sole purpose in life is to read and write to IMS. That's all it does, and it does it very well. It uses all key features of IMS, like pass calls. It knows how to translate the where clauses into IMS criteria. And when IMS returns the data back to the data connector, it passes it back to the query processor, which then takes that blob of data, which is in the IMS TAPL format, creates a relational result set out of it. Actually, that relational result set is the SQL DA, which will be familiar to DB2 users. And the SQL DA is shipped down the pipe, which is usually in TCP/IP, back to the client. So that, in short, is how the SQL processing happens. I am now on slide 6, which lays out what platforms we support. All the major Unix versions are supported for both JDBC and ODBC. And in addition, JDBC also runs on the ZOS Unix flavor, USS. It can do that because it's a type 4 driver and it's completely platform independent. Now we move on to slide 7, where I will talk a little more about how metadata is important for the product. I promise this is the last time I will talk about metadata because I know it seems that I've been talking about it a lot. And when I'm done with the slide, you will realize why it is important. One is obviously that the obvious reason is, of course, that we can, using metadata, we can translate the underlying formats like IMS, DBDs, or IDMS schemas and subschemas. We can translate those into DB2-like tables, which is, of course, very useful. It allows us to write SQL against IDMS or IMS. And we allow that to be done in a very easy manner using a GUI, Windows GUI. But there is a less obvious function to metadata. That is simulating a relational database's catalog functions. We mimic the complete set of catalog tables that DB2 has, like sysibm.sys tables, sysibm.sys columns, etc. And that allows us to support all the nice features of a rapid application development kit, like .NET Wizard, WebSphere Studio Data Explorer, and all the variety of reporting tools also have Wizard. What they do in the background is they send metadata calls to the back-end server, in this case, Classic Federation. And because we simulate catalog so perfectly, we can support all those functions. And this allows, this is what allows you to use your RAD, Rapid Application Development Toolkit, against non-relational data. That is huge, as I will demonstrate the next few slides, how we use it for creating a web app, an ETL, and SOA. The metadata, of course, does other standard things, like it translates legacy data types, like a COM3 field, into a SQL decimal field. It handles all the code page translations. It handles the little endian and big endian aspects of data conversion. It takes care of complex non-relational constructs like occurs and so on. I will now move on to the first application of this product, which is real-time mainframe access, mainframe data access from a J2E web application. This is a insurance carrier. Yeah, I've been using Classic Federation for 7 years now. It was back in 1998 when the web was still quite new. And this insurance company, being very customer-friendly, thought of exposing its operational data to its customers so that they could query their claims data in real time and get accurate information. If you've ever been in a car accident and have filed a claim, you will know that data that is a day old or even 2 days old, as the case when you are using data refreshes from COBOL Extract applications, that kind of information is not good enough for customers. It can make for really unhappy customers. So that's why this insurance company started looking at alternative solutions. The first solution was to write COBOL Extract programs. Because the data volume was so huge, they figured the data could be refreshed only every 30 hours. And as I just mentioned, it had real revenue impact. People would get turned off and go to some other insurance carrier because they could not get correct information. And because it involved setting up a parallel set of servers and databases, the estimated cost was $2 million. The second solution was to call their existing IMS transactions. They are IMS DC shops, so they had IMS online transactions, which they thought of invoking from a web app. And the estimated cost came to 10,000 man hours. Now, if you think about it, it would be clear why it was so complex, because these IMS transactions were not designed for an outside user. They were designed for use by a telephone operator who had been trained in the application, who knew how to press F12 or F8, some arcane key, and get claims information. And it required a very rigid input and gave outputs in manners which were not always obvious. So taking those inputs and outputs and formatting them in a user-friendly manner for a web app, that was very complex. So Classic Federation came in and gave them a solution, and I will show you how. We went in and took a look at the set of IMS DBDs and the relevant copybooks that were related to the claims data. It wasn't huge, about, I think, half a dozen IMS databases, which came to like 50 virtual relational mappings. Now I will talk a little more about how the mapping is done. Starts on slide 11. As I told you, it is the data mapper that you use to create the logical tables. You can think about the logical table that I've been talking about, the virtual relational mapping, in two ways. Firstly, you can think of it as a relational form of non-relational data. So you have a IMS hierarchical database, and when you finish mapping it in Classic Federation, it looks like a relational table. And the other way to look at a logical table is the data you get when you write a query. They look like, so you're actually talking to the IMS database at the back end, but your data comes back almost like from a virtual table. And it is a virtual table that has been materialized on the fly in real time by Classic Federation. This virtual table exists only in the extended memory that is being used by Classic Federation, and it is not cached anywhere. So the data that you're looking is the data that is in the database. I'm now on slide 13, which shows you a screenshot of the data mapper. In the data mapper, you create separate catalogs for separate data sources. So if you have, say, VSAM and IDMS, you would have one catalog for VSAM, one for IDMS. And that all is stored in a Microsoft Access repository. Moving on to slide 14. The mapping process starts with what I call discovery. So you need to get organized. Usually, it's the DBA, the IMS DBA, for example, who would be in charge of this. It would figure out what segments contain the data that this planned application is looking for. And download all that source, the DBD source, and the COBOL copy books down to the Windows box where the mapping is being done. Slide 15. This gives you a point-by-point description of the process. So you have the source data and the characteristics like which fields, which keys, so on. Slide 16 gives you a step-by-step description of the process. As you can see, first you create the repository, which is usually a one-time process. Second, you have the catalog that you create, one for each type, like one for VSAM, one for IDMS. And then you import the source definitions. For example, for IMS, you would load the DBD. We prefer that you download all the definitions to your Windows box. But if you need to, you can go in real time with the underlying FTP capability of the data mapper and bring it down from the mainframe. You create the table. You import the in the table. You will specify, for example, in IMS, I want this and this and this segment. So that's in the table. You're defining the structure of the table. Next, you import the COBOL copybooks to flesh out the structure. Meaning, you'll import which fields you want to go into that table. And finally, you identify the key that you will use. Once you're done, you generate the use grammar out of this definition. The use grammar looks very much like DB2 DDL. It talks about the table type. It talks about the field names, the field types. On to slide 17. This is the screenshot for creating the table that I talked about, and shows the. I'm sorry. This screenshot is for the field level import. We're importing the copybook, so it allows you to check some options. The most important option is how you deal with occurrence clauses. You have three options. First is to create a record array, which is basically taking a occurrence clause and creating a third normal form of it. Second option is expanding each occurrence clause. So that is kind of denormalizing your data. And third option is what I call the POC option. And when you're just doing it for a quick test, you don't care to flesh out the entire occurrence. You just take the first occurrence. Slide 18. Talks about some key considerations. You need to think about the occurrence clauses. You need to think about redefines. So if you have redefines, that means you're basically mapping two separate layouts. So you can have two separate virtual mappings for when you have redefines. Slide 19. These are considerations you want to keep in mind for the columns. One of the most common errors in mapping is when you're importing the columns using the copybook, you forget to specify which segment these set of fields go into. So you want to make sure you take care of that. And in the next slide, slide 20, I talk about the data types that are handled. Classic Federation handles almost all data types that you will run into. But the most common of them, because they were mostly used in the mainframe COBOL applications, are char, decimal, small int, and integer. Actually, the first two are the most common. And if you go to slide 21, it shows you how these SQL data types map into COBOL types. So the char or character maps to pick X, N, and packed decimal, which is SQL decimal, maps to the COM3 type, and so on. But the first two are the most common that we run into. And finally, slide 22 tells you how to generate the grammar. The final step in the mapping process is actually a batch job that runs on the mainframe. It's called the metadata utility. It takes the grammar that you created as input. It does some validation. For example, in case of IMS, it will read in the definitions, and then it will validate with your DBD lib that you provide in the job that this database actually exists, like you said. And it does have the databases and segments defined. So it does some kind of sanity check. And once it's done all of that, it populates the catalog. The catalog is actually a set of data set from the mainframe. And it can be physical sequential, or it can be linear VSAM. We prefer linear VSAM because they get loaded in extended storage and makes performance a lot better. One key thing to keep in mind, and this is something that causes confusion pretty often, is even though the system catalogs contain DB2-like system tables, like sysibm.sys-table, sysibm.sys-column, sysibm.sys-indexes, you do not need DB2 on the mainframe to run Classic Federation. It just makes the underlying data look like DB2. It does not prerequisite DB2. Slide 24. This is our familiar TSO running the metadata job here. And the key things to look at is how I specify the catalog. Those are specified in the CAC CAD and CAC INDX DDs. Then the next step is to configure the Classic Federation server when you have finished mapping. And that includes providing a TCP IP address, port number. This you can see in slide 30. Slide 31. I'm sorry. I'm off on slide number. I'm on slide 26. I'm sorry. Slide 26. Slide 26 shows the data server started up. The key things to keep in mind is you should have messages from all the threads that are starting underneath this started task, like the query processor, the controller. They should also show started. That means it's been initiated successfully, no errors. And the keyword you look for is ready. Then that shows the server is up and running. It's listening on a TCP IP socket and ready to serve any SQL request. Now we go to the client side, which is slide 27. Slide 27, I show you how to create a JDBC provider for the Classic Federation driver within WebSphere. As of now, it's, Classic Federation is not one of the off-the-shelf providers within WebSphere Studio. So you create a user-defined provider, and we provide a class for you to do that, which is connection pool data source. So you point your wizard at the Classic Federation JDBC driver jar file. The entire Classic Federation JDBC driver comes in one jar file, which is about a meg in size. It's really small, really lean and mean, like we like to call it, and has no thread affinity whatsoever, so it is, can be highly scalable, can be massively multi-threaded. Anyway, it's out of the jar file, you specify the connection pool data source at the class, and that allows you to create the provider. Slide 28. Here I show you how to create the data source. From here on, it's pretty much standard. You're creating a JNDI name for the data source. You provide it the data store helper class, which is standard within WebSphere. And the key configuration parameters come in slide 30. There you specify three strings. One is the database name. The database name corresponds to the data source name. And if you go back to slide 25, slide 25, you'll see a definition for CACQP. That is the query processor definition, and the whatever whatever is the name of the service has to go in the string here in slide 30 with database name. That is where you tie in the server with the JDBC client. That is the hook between the two. The other two parameters are the port and server name. The port is the TCP IP port that you configured. That's also back in slide 25. And server name is the IP address. Slide 31 shows you what the data source will look like after you have finished configuring it. And slide 32 shows you a very simple bean code. As you will figure out, it's just a standard JDBC app there's nothing special that you need to remember. So JDBC connection that you create, create a prepared statement, execute it, and get the results out of it. It's useful to know that Classic Federation does support CAST statements. So when you say prepared statement within your Java code, it doesn't necessarily mean that Classic Federation is going to the huge expense of preparing a statement at the back end. It could be that within your WebSphere configuration, you have configured it to cache those statements. Say you want to cache 50 instances of it. Classic Federation is smart enough to keep a cache of those 50 copies at the back end. So it is highly efficient and in tune with what WebSphere does for performance optimization. And slide 33 pretty much ties in together what I've been talking about up until now. If you remember the initial slide where I showed you the insurance company's problem, Classic Federation came in and it cost about 1/8 of the alternatives in terms of money, 1/5 in terms of man hours, and actually the customer was able to put their application, initial application in production within 2 months. It was that quick. And like I said, they've been using it for 7 years now. Actually going on 8. The next application that I will talk about is real-time ETL of mainframe data. Now, before I go into the ETL part, I'll just briefly talk about how nothing really changes in the back end. You have done the mapping. You have created the relational views of your non-relational data. It's there in the catalog, and it's available for any application to use, whether it is real-time web access or real-time ETL. Once you have done it at the back end, it's just your incremental cost is zero. So I've done all the mapping at the back end, so just using the same mapping, I can go on to the ETL part. So slide 35 shows you the second problem. This is at another customer that's been with us for, I think, 6 years now. They're one of the largest international manufacturers of recreational vehicles and motorcycles. They needed to create sales reports for their marketing and sales organizations, and they were hampered by obsolete and inaccurate information from their data marts, because when they needed some kind of new data, they had to commission a COBOL programmer to write extract programs, and which often between commissioning and coding and testing took 2 to 3 weeks. And not to speak about the cost of maintaining these programs. And that clearly was not enough, because it's a very highly competitive industry, and patterns change in a matter of a week. So business intelligence that was 3 weeks old was no good. So in comes ETL solution from IBM. Data stage is a leader in extract, transform, and load ETL applications. I will not go into a lot of detail about data stage, because it's a well-known product, and our focus here is on Classic Federation. But here I just give you over some material on getting familiar with data state. Slide 37 shows you the designer. That's the place where you create the jobs to do what you want, can access data, transform it, and load it into your target platform. If you move on to slide 40, shows you how you can import classic federation tables using ODBC stage in the data stage designer view. The screenshot showing how you define the data source, identify the tables you want to import, and how you import the fields. And slide 41 talks about probably the most important stage that you will ever use in data stage, which is the transformer. This is a function that allows you to read data and transform it in any way you like, and then load it into the target. Slide 42 shows you a sample job. Actually, most jobs that you will create would actually look quite as simple as this, because on one end, you see the IMS data. The complexity of accessing IMS data has been completely hidden by the classic federation piece. All of that is now just one SQL statement. And when that part is done, next part, the next piece of the complexity, which is transforming the mainframe pieces. Like, you might have a pretty simple example. You might have product by product codes, and they might not be very obvious to someone who is looking at reports. So you want to flesh out the product codes into descriptive language. You can use the transformer to do that. And once you have done that, you can load it into the target UDB database, which is what this job in slide 42 does. And finally, slide 43, you have your real-time ETL. And the forwarded case to this customer was that development time was literally slashed in half. And the cost fell in same proportion. It made life much simpler for the management team, because they only had to manage one team now, which could do it all. And they were able to expand the use of this business intelligence tool to real-time reporting. The last application that I will talk about is one that is most exciting for me, and I'm sure for a lot of the listeners, SOA. This is really new, and one that IBM has been giving a lot of importance to, because it makes life so much easier for IT managers, even IT developers, because you can reuse the same interface over and over again. And the way there are many ways to do implement SOA infrastructure, and one of them is actually going straight at the data, and that's the one I will talk about. Slide 45, I show you how data stage RTI component. This data stage is the same one that I used in the previous application, except that it is the SOA edition. It has a real-time component. So provide the real-time input to the transformer. Transformer gets the relevant information from Classic Federation, which underlying, of course, their mainframe data, which in this case is IMS. And it will do the transformation and output it to in a web service format. Slide 46 is the key thing. This took me a while to figure out, so it's important for our listeners to know that the transformer piece, when you're doing this kind of a T kind of architecture, it requires you to define the key explicitly. That tells it to use the input, the RTI input that I show in slide 45, and get the just the relevant piece of information from IMS and transform it back out to the RTI output. Slides 47 and 48 are related to deploying this web service that you just created. And slide 48 is actually a third-party application called Soapscape, which is one of the major soap development toolkits. It allows me to test the web service that I just created. And slide 49 shows you the result. So to tie it all up in slide 50, this goes back to the previous application. Now this customer that I talked about in my last application, the ETL, they are looking to go beyond the sales report that they have created from the data mart using ETL. They're looking to provide services to, say, a salesperson. They want to open up a wireless-enabled portal. So they want to create a web service for a credit score for a given customer. So a salesperson talking to the customer can in real time invoke his this application over his cell phone. Like, now there are some pretty powerful Wi-Fi. WAP-enabled cell phones that can invoke web services. And what happens there is this web service actually goes into data stage RTI, invokes the job, that and goes to the IMS database, gets the data, and transforms it into a format that web application would understand. So I think that's pretty incredible that you can have a wireless cell phone accessing IMS data in real time. And that's just one of the applications that they're thinking about in this customer. They also plan to have partners, say, even retail stores where they sell these recreational vehicles, access this manufacturer's IMS data in real time using this controlled web services. With that, I will wrap up my piece. Slide 51 talks about the various scenarios where you can use Classic Federation. I just gave you three applications. There are many more that you can think of. You can see some other products that are using Classic Federation underneath, like the WBI Message Broker, Business Objects Data Integrator, Business Objects Crystal Reports, Sun, CBeyond, ICANN. So the choices are limitless because Classic Federation provides you standard JDBC and ODBC access in a very scalable manner. And you can use it to pretty much integrate it with any tool you can think of. With slide 53, where I summarize the values that Classic Federation brings to business, I will wrap up. Using Classic Federation, you can extend your mainframe investment. There would be no better example than the one that I last gave you, giving access to wireless applications through a cell phone to your existing IMS data. You do that using absolutely no mainframe programming at all, using standard tools like DataStage, Network, your web services. And at the other end, Classic Federation integrates seamlessly into your existing infrastructure, so you can use your existing security and accounting tools. And you can use your monitors like Strobe and OmegaMon to monitor it. And at the client side, you can develop all these applications with personnel that have no mainframe knowledge. That is a huge return on investment that is free benefits bring you. So with that, I will wrap up and turn it over to Beth. Take it away, Beth.
Thank you, Raj. And I'm going to give you a second here to switch presentations. And you should now be on the queue replication piece, which is a solution for continuous DB2 availability and lots of cool new features. My name is Beth Hamill. I've worked with probably lots of you in the past on our replication solutions, and I'm really focusing at this time on working with our customers and working in the sales space. Now, if you look at the agenda on page 2, slide 2, what I'd like to do is give you an update on queue replication. I really like every time I speak to the folks out there in telephone land, I'd like you to hear something new. And so I'm going to start with the basics because you might be new to us completely and never heard about our products. So I'll give you just a quick, brief overview of our basics. Then I'd like to talk a little bit about how replication works as a continuous availability solution. This is one of our very popular applications among many. And then in case you've heard about our product before but you'd like to hear about what's new, I'd like to tell you about some of our new exciting features that we made available over the past year, and those might exist in the product as it comes with a particular fixed pack or PTF level, or it might be something that you can download right now today off the web, and some of those are really very cool. So it's very fun for me to talk about this stuff. And, you know, just to follow on from where Raj just left off, Information Integrator is a really broad space for us at IBM. We have so many different products that range from what was the legacy Essential set of products, including the DataStage, all the way through Federation, Classic Event Publishers, and then our replication products, which we've had around since the early 90s, and we just keep getting better with this stuff. And so I'm speaking specifically about WebSphere Information Integrator Queue Replication. Now, if you join me on slide 3, here's the basics. We are a product that is using WebSphere MQ Series as a delivery mechanism from a source system to a target system. And those funny little gray boxes with arrows on them, that happens to be an icon that we use within our GUI and within these various presentations to indicate queues. So what you see is that data, which is captured off of a DB2 log, can then be held in memory, formulated into transactions as they occurred from the source system, sent on an MQ series queue to another system, where they are picked up by a queue apply process and dispatched against multiple target tables using one or many agents, and that's your choice. So we can apply the data serially, completely, or in a highly parallelized manner, but in such a way that the data is always completing its data integrity. It has transactional integrity. It has consistency. And for any particular table, any particular keys, we are never disturbing the serialization of that data. So we're applying data. Now, this picture is shown in a unidirectional manner just to simplify the initial discussion here. but we support unidirectional flow of data, bidirectional, peer-to-peer. So there's a lot of different ways to use this product, and it is suitable for a great variety of applications. Typically, the way that this is set up in a customer shop is that you'll have an administration component that is sitting on, and again, typically on a different server. So, for example, a popular way to use this product might be that Capture is on a DB2 for ZOS database, and the Apply could be another DB2 ZOS, DB2 for Linux, Unix, or Windows. And I frequently use LUW to describe that distributed space. It could be an Oracle target. Then I might have an administration component that's sitting on Windows and could be running either a GUI-based replication center, or I can be using our more power user version of the admin, which we call ASMCLP for command line processor, and that allows you to either use a command line or, very popularly, a script. And I'd say about half of our users go with the GUI, and about half go with using these power scripts. And then finally, there's also an alert monitor piece to this product, which can run on one of the servers where Capture and Apply run or separately. And that alert monitor can be keeping an eye on all of your replication processes and the queues that are being used as well, the control tables, and then can alert you through the console, system console, or through an email that it sees something it doesn't like. A certain threshold has passed. You've said, alert me if my latency is lower than 2 minutes, if it's higher than 2 minutes, or let me know if the capture process has stopped. And then you can get proactively alerted in these conditions. So now that is the general picture. This is the product I'm talking about today, capturing and applying data in a unidirectional or multidirectional way using MQ Series. And now I'm going to start talking about some of the applications of this, or at least specifically one application that's very popular, which is our continuous availability. And then I'll go on to tell you some of the cool new things that we're doing to make the experience better for the user. So on slide 4, I talked to a lot of customers about what I like to now call continuous availability, as opposed to high availability. And why I like continuous availability is because something that we can do quite uniquely with Queue Replication is really provide continuous availability through any kind of planned outage, and scheduled outages are still the biggest hitter for most organizations, because no matter how much we do with our databases to make them more resilient to scheduled outage, there still seem to be things that you need to upgrade, like your applications, yours or vendor applications, like upgrades to other software, to your hardware. There are database migrations as well as application migrations. And so we talk a lot about planned outages and being able to be resilient with your business through these planned outages. Unplanned outages, of course, everybody wants to avoid. Disasters, everybody wants to avoid, but sometimes it's just not possible. The power grid goes out, or there's something that happens at your primary site that you really need to be resilient to. And so here, we want to be able to give you a second copy of your data, and possibly quite remote from the primary copy, so that you can just keep your business going without a hiccup. And maybe your customers don't even need to know about the disaster or failure that has occurred. Now, we have another class of customers. This is a smaller class, but it is growing, who are doing a kind of a global distribution of their data. And this is another kind of capability or another class of availability, where you might have your data distributed or completely copied from one continent to another. Very popular with financials, maybe one copy is in London, the next to New York, and the third is in Tokyo, and we hear this one over and over again. And this data you want to update locally, but you would like to see a global picture of this data. And therefore, replication can keep you in sync and make your data highly available at all of those locations. Now, if you go to slide 5, so how does qReplication help you to actually achieve continuous availability? So typically, let's just show it with 2 sites. There could be more than 2 sites, but typically a 2-site configuration looks like what you're seeing here, that you have your full suite of read-write applications pointed at a particular DB2 server, such as DSNA, pictured here. And you are capturing that data real-time with very low latency through MQ to a target server, in this case DSNB. Now, DSNB is a live DB2 database. It is active, and therefore, as you see up in the top right-hand corner, you could also have read-only applications that were going against DSNB, thus tremendously improving your return on investment for having this second copy of your data. It is not just an insurance policy. It can also be used live. So you're applying this data real-time against DSNB, but you are prepared at any moment with a connection so that you could flip your read-write applications to DSNB and start capturing that data and be prepared to take that data back to DSNA for resynchronization at a later point in time. Now, if you go to slide 6, there are multiple ways I've seen people configure our product for a continuous availability scenario, just as I have described on slide 5. It could be unidirectional, in which case you are not prepared to capture changes at the target, but at some point in time, you might come back and, after a failure, then do a different method to resynchronize. And some customers I have seen do that. Probably the most popular configuration would be what I've circled here as bidirectional, which says typically I'm never going to be making updates at more than one server at a time. I make my updates at the primary database, and then if I have a failure or a planned outage, I switch control to the secondary, and my updates are there. And then at some point in time, I may need to do some small amount of resynchronization between these two sites, but I don't need a very heavyweight conflict detection or resolution strategy because typically I am not creating too many conflicts here. So bidirectional is a lightweight conflict detection mechanism that allows you to say, okay, the secondary, since it would be the updates that occurred after a failover, they win in a case of I have some small number of conflicts. And then at the bottom of the page, we also have a very heavyweight, you know, very robust, incredibly robust and probably best of breed peer-to-peer conflict resolution, detection and resolution mechanism, so that you could have here more than 2 servers if you like, such as the 3 servers involved in the major financial hubs, or it could be among a certain set of your headquarter mainframes. You could have a peer-to-peer strategy that involves more than one server and very robust conflict handling. On slide 7, let me just go through quickly what are the advantages and disadvantages of using such a mechanism. And obviously, there are other mechanisms. You can use hardware. Many customers use hardware, and some use both. With DB2 on Linux, Unix, Windows, there's also the HADR mechanism. And so frequently I'm asked, so, you know, how do you compare these, and why might I think about using the logical qReplication for CA? And so I say, hey, this is the very fastest switchover that you can get with transactionally consistent data. Because the secondary is live, you can immediately switch to it in the case of an outage. It's an excellent solution for scheduled outages and, in fact, for testing your strategy because it's very simple to do your switches and switchbacks. It's not a matter of reconfiguring hardware or anything very painful. You don't have to restart a DB2. You can just switch. So this is a very pleasant aspect of being able to do scheduled outages, is it's very painless. You just switch the applications. the secondary database, since it's live, allows that read or write activity, and this is just critical to many of our customers. And obviously, if you're doing a geographically dispersed database scenario, this is the only solution. You can't use hardware to do that kind of a strategy. As I mentioned, it could be a supplemental solution. You could have hardware for a short hop failover solution and queue applications for your long distance. In some cases, I've heard that a customer finds this attractive because they can use a slightly lower cost secondary system. So where the primary might be a 9-way or 12-way sysplex, maybe the secondary is a 6-way. And if you had to switch over to that 6-way, then you might run at a reduced speed, of course, and capacity over the 12-way. But the point is, it was lower cost to set up that secondary, and you're still running after the failover. That's very, very critical. You're still running. And, of course, this is an asynchronous solution, so it is a very low impact on your source. And we've really strived with our queue capture process to be as low CPU as we possibly can in our consumption to minimize any kind of impact on your source system. Now, I'll be quick to point out that we are not perfect. In fact, I've not seen any CA solution, any continuous availability solution that is perfect. Because we're asynchronous, then data can be temporarily or permanently lost depending on your failure. If your primary system is completely lost and irretrievable, then some data could be lost. This is why we go for the lowest latency that we possibly can, and we're talking in some cases we have customers running at a very low number of seconds latency between two WAN-connected sites. And the reason we're going for that low latency is exactly this, to minimize any potential for lost data. And second, there is application awareness that is needed here that would not necessarily be needed, say, in a hardware solution. For example, if you have triggers, the triggers probably need to be set up to be conditional so that when the data is updated by our apply, that the triggers don't fire. And that's kind of a wrap-up here on using queue replication for continuous availability, and we can take questions on this later. Remember, we have a Q&A session at the end of my presentation for both Raj, who's standing by, and myself. All right, so now I'm moving on to new product features, which gets me very excited. Slide 9, a couple of things that we added, some rather large things we added in last year, in 2005. We did change the product so that the MQ server could be on a separate Linux, Unix, Windows machine. What we found is some of our early adopters do not want to run the MQ server on the same machine as their DB2 server. So on those platforms where it's allowed to separate the client and server, which is the Linux, Unix, Windows set, we've allowed the product to be configured that way so that your capture can be running on one system and the server on another. If you go to slide 10, major new feature, and a lot of folks have not heard this, so I want to make sure that you get this word. A major new feature that was introduced last year was our ability to address targets that are non-DB2. So we have DB2 for Z and DB2 for Linux, Unix, Windows as sources for queue replication, but as targets, in addition to those two different DB2s, the Linux, Unix, Windows, and DB2Z, we've added Oracle, Sybase, Microsoft SQL Server, and Informix as targets. And that is all available right now. And as you can see in this picture, it can be flexibly configured. Our apply could be on the same machine with your Oracle target, or it could be on a different machine. So we have a lot of different ways that you can set that up. Very powerful new feature and very popular with those folks that know that we have this capability. On slide 11, this is sort of an assorted list of other things that we added in 2005. We unfortunately, when we came out in GA, used a hard-coded cue name for certain internal dynamic cues that we generated. And, of course, that's a no-no. So we've taken that out. It is possible always to use your own cue names, just as we've always allowed you to use your own high-level qualifiers for control tables and so on. Now, for the replication sensor, we added support for single sign-on that was already there for the apply, the capture, and the monitor, and we needed to enhance our replication sensor so that your whole configuration can be supporting single sign-on. In our replication sensor, we made some changes there, what I'll call a little dialogue facelift, and I'm actually going to show you pictures of that in the next section. And it was to address a little bit of complexity people were feeling in terms of creating what we call QMAPs. So I'm going to explain that in a sec. When we first came out GA, we had a feature just for unidirectional, another very popular feature, to be able to alter, add columns to your tables with as little pain as possible. So if you alter added a column to your source, you give a signal to our capture, and then we handle it from there. We change our metadata. We can alter the target table for you if you like. And within a fixed pack in 2005, we extended that support to both peer-to-peer and bidirectional environments. By popular request, we did that. We had a little bit of a nuisance with cascade deletes where we would raise exceptions when we tried to delete something at the target that already had been deleted through a cascade that occurred there at that target. So we got rid of that nuisance and we no longer will raise exceptions for those. And then finally, and quite a significant feature, there are a number of vendor applications in the world that provide you with some number of tables in your application space that have no unique index, have no primary key, and those give you a little bit of trouble when you're trying to do replication because most replication products require that there is some kind of unique identifier so that we can find the row at the target to update or delete. But when we go and talk to these vendors, they say, well, you know, these are probably small tables, maybe one single row, they're metadata tables, and you shouldn't be worried about that. So just provide a kind of a rudimentary support in replication to allow us to have those kind of tables. And so we have added that capability. So this means that if I wanted to replicate, say, a PeopleSoft application that has 10,000 tables and 400 of them have no unique index, I can still do a mass define of all of my subscriptions at that source system and not worry about those 400 tables that did not have a unique identifier. We have a new rule to be able to handle that. All right, now I'm moving on to some features that you can download today off of the web that are very cool and very fun. Starting at slide 13, we have a notion of a kind of a logical construct called a QMAP. And we're not in the business of trying to make your life difficult. We actually are trying to make it easier. And so we were looking at the set of cues that you might use over and over and over again between a pair of capture and apply components. So that's the data, you know, the send the data out cue. It's the receive the data in cue. It's the messages from apply back to capture cue. This is your pipe, if you will, from one capture to one apply. And so we call that pipe a replication queue map. It just names a set of queues, and you can just call it Fred, and then every time you want to set up a new subscription, a new set of tables between that pair, then you just say, I would like to send that data on Fred, and therefore not have to type out lengthy queue names or go remember what queue names you use between those two. You can just say, I use Fred. Now, what we found was our early adopters thought that building or defining using our GUI one of these replication queue maps was a little tricky. So we made it easier by making it more visually oriented. The first panel, which I'll show you in a couple slides, was very data entry oriented and gave you no clues or no cues as to, well, where's the send queue, where's the receive queue, and so on. So now if you go to slide 14, here's what this new facelift looks like. And you'll see it looks a little bit like my picture did. Now, you actually see on the slide, there's a capture, there's an apply, there's some cues on the capture side, there's some cues on the apply side. And we give you these visual reference points so that you can see what you're doing. And if you go to slide 15, now you see the difference here. On the right, very data entry. Here, just name this, name this, name this, with no help whatsoever as to, well, what are you guys asking me for? You're asking me for something that you understand, but I don't. And you see the new improved version here on the left, a much nicer, much friendlier interface to allow you to say, oh, yeah, I get it. This is the cue that I defined over on the capture side. That's what I type in here. And this is the one I did on the apply side. So I particularly like this. I think it addressed the problem very well. But then it didn't stop there. So now, I said these were all downloadable features. This actually, if you have FixPack 10 installed, you have this this new dialog. But now, on slide 16, you can enhance, if you have that level of the code and you have that picture, you can enhance that picture by downloading a new stored procedure. This stored procedure is something that would help you with DB2 for Linux, Unix, Windows, sources, and targets. So if I'm using a source and target on DB2, Linux, Unix, Windows, I can put a stored proc on those servers. And with that stored proc, I now have this, what you see is an ellipsis, which generally is an indicator on any one of our dialogs that says, hey, you can do a pull-down list from here. You click on this, and we're going to give you some choices. So instead of just typing in the queue names, then, we're actually going to then give you a list of queues to choose from. So if you go to slide 17, you see I clicked on the ellipsis, and I was brought up a list of here are all the queues that exist there, and you can just choose from that list. So as I mentioned, first of all, you have to have FixPack 10. You would download this stored procedure and put it on your DB2 LUW servers, and then you would have this great new capability, which will be part of the product in version 9, available at the end of this year. And it will then, at that point, when it's in the full product, will also support DB2Z, I'm very happy to say. So this is an exciting thing that you can look at now and make available on all your DB2s as of version 9 at the end of the year. Now, if you go to slide 18, then in addition to just being able to list queues, you also, with this stored procedure, can validate those queues. So if you press the button and say, I want to validate that I typed in the right stuff and this makes sense, then if you go to slide 19, it will actually test that queue out for you and give you a message saying, yes, that worked. I did a test and I had no failures and I was able to use the queues as you define them to me. So therefore, not having a runtime failure, but being able to set all this up with some good degree of confidence during the implementation phase and the install phase. Okay, now I'm going to change gears to another tool. On slide 20, we have a new live monitor. And the live monitor and the dashboard that I'm going to show you later, this is really fun stuff. Now, whereas we have the alert monitor, which runs as a kind of background task and is just looking for trouble and will tell you about trouble if it sees it, sometimes what you'd like is something that you can just look at yourself interactively and get a feeling for how things are going. And that's where this live monitor comes in. And so this is very graphical. It's very pretty and cool to look at. It ticks along, and every time our apply puts a row out to its own monitor table, then you're going to get another bar on this little live monitor. So the monitor would go pretty slowly ticking by if you were only putting a row out every 10 minutes. But if you were like checking every, let's say, 10 seconds, 5 seconds, then it's going to tick along and it's going to show you, here's how I'm going. Here's my latency picture. Here's how my latency looks like for capture, for the queue, for the apply. I give you some idea of the throughput that you're getting. And, you just have a at-a-glance notion of the health of your system. Very fun stuff. In addition, on slide 21, it will let you know if one of these processes became inactive. It's just going to pop you up a red window and say that process is no longer active. On slide 22, within those little bars, as they tick along, if you actually had a problem with a particular row and we raised an exception, that shows as a red bar on your live monitor, so you would know immediately, oh, that red bar shows a problem. Maybe your alert monitor is also sending you an alert about that. And if you go to slide 23, you can actually drill down on that exception. So you say, oh, I know an exception occurred. Let me go to View, Exceptions, something that occurred in the last minute or last 10, and it'll bring up a View Exceptions window so that you can drill down and get down to the detail. So some really nice usability here that fundamentally gets you to an answer to a question very quickly without having to go find the SQL to go get into these tables and look to see what's going on. Slide 24, same kind of thing for capture. What's my overall latency? What does my throughput look like? So a live monitor for capture. And then on slide 25, and very cool, let's tie all this together and get health of everything. So here I can have a dashboard that shows me my apply on system 1, my apply on system 2, my capture on system 1, my capture on system 2, and let me get into some details if I want to on any of the table names. I can drill down. Let's go to page slide 26. I can actually go into that dashboard at the bottom and actually get right down to the subscription level and see what's going on with this particular subscription. Is it activated yet? Maybe I haven't activated it. Oh, maybe it's partially active in a peer-to-peer. It's active in one direction and it's still activating in the reverse. Is everything good? Is everything active? So very exciting stuff, very intuitive, very easy to install and use. Slide 27, we're just giving you the URL there where you can go find those tools today and try them out. And now I'm going to go quickly through one more tool here, which I think is terrific. On slide 28, I didn't even know you could do this with a PDF, but this is an interactive PDF, and all I've needed on my system to be able to use this is just my standard downloaded free Adobe Reader. You don't need anything more special than that. So if you download this interactive MQ checklist, which we have for several environments, we have it for unidirectional, peer-to-peer, and so on, you can use this to generate all of the scripts you need to build all of your Q objects. So here for MQ, you can type in all these fields that you see here on slide 28, you can type in all the data on these fields, and then on page 2, you will end up with a generated script to use for the source system, and on page 3, something for the target system. Very cool. Now, if I just walk through this real quickly, on slide 29, I can actually click on sample entries up at the top right-hand corner here, and it will fill my page here with some sample entries just so that you can test this out so you can see how it works. Now, I wanted to point out that you always get this funny message the first time you try this that says you can't save a completed copy of this form. That's normal, and you can just ignore that. But what you can do, even if you can't save this form, you can print it, or you can cut and paste from the generated scripts and then put that into your own batch job, into your own text file, whatever. On slide 30, so here's what happened. When I clicked on sample entries, it filled all this data in. It, you know, filled in some samples so that I can just try out the procedure. So it put in some dummy IP addresses, some dummy names, and then I would be able to follow along on slide 31. On my page 2, I would see this is what it generated for my source script. Here's all the cues I need. Here's all the start commands I need, all the channels that I need to find. And likewise, on slide 32, here's everything I need on the target system. Same thing. Here's my channels. Here are my cues, and here's a start command to start the channels. So very cool. I like this a lot. It can't get much simpler than being able to type in the queue names and have it generate everything you need to build all of that stuff. So finishing up here on slide 33, always best place to go for all of our information, including downloadable cool new features, all of our white papers, tutorials, and there sure is a lot of good stuff out there. Then I usually just Google queue replication roadmap, but I've given you the URLs here to put into your favorites so that you can go find our information anytime you like. And with that, I'm done, Diane, and we're ready to go for Q&A. Thank you, folks.
Leader, could you open it up for Q&A, please?
Certainly, thank you. Today's question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question today, please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone. If you are joining us with a phone that has a mute function, please make sure the mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, that is star 1 if you would like to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to allow you a chance to signal. And once again, that is star 1 to ask a question. We'll go first to Chuck Lomicki.
Yes, the question I have is, I did not see the ability to invoke application code logic. I understand that we can get to the data, and then we can develop logic to work or process the data, but one of the things that we need to do in my organization is we'd like to invoke, really, the CICS application code logic in a number of cases, and I didn't see we can do that. Maybe I missed that, but that's my question.
I assume it's for me, for the Classic Federation piece. Yes, we have had many requests for that functionality, and I know it's in development pipeline, but I don't have a date yet. But we can, for other people who are interested, we can invoke IMS transactions, just not CICS transactions yet.
And when you say you can invoke, what would I need to do that?
In that case, the application would invoke stored procedures from the JDBC or ODBC interface. So they would provide input parameters, and they would be executed as stored procedures at the back end by invoking the relevant transactions, and the result would be sent back either as output parameters or as result sets.
How do we pass the data to the application via XML? Like, in other words, normally when you're interacting in a CICS environment, mm-hmm. sending a screen's worth of information for the application to then process. How do I emulate or simulate that?
From your application, from a WebSphere application, server application, you input the input data, through a web page, and that would be passed into the stored procedure invocation, and then Classic Federation would have a bridge, an APPC bridge into CICS, so it would invoke the relevant. Right now we do that same thing for IMS transaction, and that's how I'm able to answer the question. For IMS transactions, it just goes over APPC, invokes the IMS transaction, gets the data back. So it kind of bypasses, kind of similar to what the screen does at the transport level and the APPC level.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
And there are no further questions at this time. Once again, it is star 1 to ask a question. And we do have one from Catherine Mitchell.
Hello. I have a question on the Classic Federation. We are interested in being able to update IMS from our web applications, and I'm wondering if we could use the SQL to make updates that would then get back to the DO1 database in IMS.
Yes, absolutely. If you remember, one of the first slides, I talked about how Classic Federation is fully transactional. So we can provide full transactional capability. So you can update your IMS DBs, and if required, you can roll back or do a commit, anything that you would be able to do directly to your database from your DL1 app.
Okay. So once you have the maps defined, mm-hmm. that mapping capability, it's essentially like any SQL, you can do select or insert or delete, whatever you need to do, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay. Great. Thanks.
Sure.
Next is Mohammed Hajar.
Yes, good morning. I have a quick question just to follow up on the previous. It's with respect to, I'm looking at updating data comp tables. Now, is it ANSI SQL that we would be using to actually interface with the information integrator?
Yes, the level that we support is SQL 92. So any statement that is compatible with that level, we will support.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome.
If there are no further questions, Ms. McCallum, I'll turn the call back over to you.
Thank you, everyone, for taking time out of your busy schedules to attend. Imagine not having to write a single line of mainframe code, but being able to create web access, SOA, ETL, and business continuity solutions. A special thanks goes out to Raj Dada and Beth Hamill, both from IBM, for being our speakers today. If you should have any questions, please do not hesitate to contact me, and I will be glad to put you in touch with a DB2 Tools or an II Tools sales or technical sales specialist. Our next DB2 Tools presentation will be on June 8th, entitled DB2 Utilities, A New Day, A New Way. Goodbye, everybody, and have a great day.
Once again, thank you all for joining us. That does conclude today's presentation. Have a great day.